Welcome to Reboot Republic, the podcast that goes behind the headlines and looks at the big issues in this republic of inequality. We are the podcast of solutions and the podcast of hope, and I'm your host, Rory Hearn. And today we have another budget special. We've had one on health, and we've looked at children inequality and gender. We're also going to have one on housing. The government's budget is coming up on October 12th, very soon. And of course, the budget is one of the key events in the year in terms of deciding how our economy is run, the decisions that are made. So today we have a motley crew of rabble-rousers, intellects, economists, and all sorts who are going to give you the ultimate budget analysis before the budget and really tell us what should be in the budget. So we're joined by Colette Bennett from Social Justice Ireland, Tom MacDonald from the Nevin Economic Research Institute, Michael Taft from SIPTU, and Tricia Keelty from St. Vincent de Paul. And to start off with, there's lots of us on this podcast, and all of you, each of you could probably do at least 4 hours by yourselves on the budget. So please jump in as much as possible on each other. We'll start with Eeny, Miny, Moe. Tricia, why don't you go with what's the St. Vincent de Paul saying the government should do in this budget, like really do, to solve equality, address inequality, make some real progressive change in addressing poverty in Ireland today?
Well, I suppose our main focus is on the key issues that are coming up from our membership, and our policy areas and our policy priorities link in with those, and they include energy, income supports, housing and education. So overall, we'd like to see that this budget actually seeks to address poverty and makes really sustained investment in the measures that are needed to do so. We actually hosted a webinar this morning and we had speakers from New Zealand, and it was really interesting because they've done lots of innovative work in terms of their budget process. So one of the things that they have done is, one, they've legislated to end child poverty. Two, they have amended their public finance bill, which means that in preparing their budgets, they have to properly proof all the decisions that they're implementing to make sure that they don't increase poverty, but in fact reduce it. So I know the Programme for Government has committed to a wellbeing budget, so it would be really important to see that it actually came to fruition, that there was clear intent in terms of reducing poverty. And to start with, that would mean increasing social welfare payments. You know, the pandemic has really shone a light on the inadequacy of social welfare and the gap between current social welfare rates and what it costs to afford a minimum essential standard of living. So we didn't have an increase in social welfare rates in the last budget. And I think if there isn't an increase now, those who are already in poverty are going to fall further behind. So that would be one of our number one priorities in terms of the budget. Then we just need to see investment in things like education. You know, children have really been impacted by the pandemic. We need to invest in schools. We need to invest in educational disadvantage and measures to tackle it, so that children who have been impacted by school closures don't fall further behind. So we'd like to see investment prioritised in that area as well. In terms of energy, this is obviously a core issue for us. And, you know, we're seeing since the moratorium on disconnections was lifted, we have about a 20% increase in requests for help for utility bills. So there is going to be need to be a sustained focus on household debt, and non-mortgage debt needs to be included in that. So whether that's debt relief for people with high energy bills, but also we need to see a mechanism in place for rent arrears as well. The legislation puts evictions on hold for rent arrears, but it doesn't deal with the actual issue of rent arrears. So it's just kicking the can down the road.
In terms of St. Vincent de Paul, is the issue of rent arrears coming up in terms of of people engaging?
It hasn't come up yet, but we expect it will, because within the legislation, the new legislation, people are asked to engage with MABs. And I suppose MABS can work out a payment plan with between the landlord and the tenant. But if there's a gap between what the tenant can afford to pay and the actual rent, then we may get requests then to fill that gap. So what we'd like to see is the Department of Housing and the Department of Social Protection setting up a joint budget line to actually address that, so that they can intervene to prevent people becoming homeless. Because if that rent arrears issue isn't sorted and they can be proactive and start doing that now, we're going to see a surge in homelessness as a result, unfortunately.
Okay, thanks Tricia for that. Tom McDonald from the Nevin Economic Research Institute, you have advocated for a wealth tax in the past. Does the government not take in lots of wealth taxes already?
Well, the wealth tax that I've discussed in particular, it would be a net wealth tax. So that would be a tax on net assets in excess of 1 million. And I estimated, 6-7 years back now, that you could bring in hundreds of millions by doing that. And a recent central bank report from just last week showed that the value of net assets in Ireland has increased significantly in the last few years. Alongside that, we do have some existing wealth taxes. Probably the most significant is the tax on inheritance and gifts, capital acquisitions tax, that brings in a few hundred million a year. We've strongly advocated that the reliefs associated with that need to be made much less generous, because those are tax breaks for people that are essentially receiving hundreds of thousands for doing nothing at all. And again, that tax brings in hundreds of millions, but could bring in hundreds of millions more. And in the long run, what generates inequality is not so much income inequality, but wealth inequality. Wealth inequality compounds over time and builds on itself. And if it isn't broken as a cycle through net wealth taxes, through inheritance taxes, through gift taxes, it simply becomes worse and worse over time. Some people argue, of course, that the local property tax is a form of wealth tax, and it is a type of wealth tax, but it isn't a pure wealth tax. My own view is that the property tax should be increased, and over the medium term should probably be trebled. We know that's not going to happen in the budget this year. That's one of the few taxes, alongside a net wealth tax and an inheritance tax, that could be increased without doing any damage to the economy. And in the short term, and I'm thinking budget 2021 here, it would be a mistake to increase taxes on labour, for example, given the weakness of the labour market at the moment. And 2021 is going to be a very, very difficult year. I think it'll be well into 2021 before we really see any kind of significant recovery. In the medium term, we do need to increase taxes on labour, employer PSI in particular, is way off what it is in other European countries. I know Michael might talk about this. And gradually over time, we would like to see employer PSI increase, but not just yet.
So in terms of taxation, do you think that, so you're recommending essentially that the only change that should be happening in taxation is an increase in a wealth tax and wealth taxes?
Well, a wealth tax should be introduced. Also, some of the reliefs associated with capital acquisitions tax, that's the inheritance tax, should be removed or made much less generous. And in addition, we would increase the local property tax. And alongside that, there may even be scope for reducing the generosity of some tax expenditures that are out there. But by and large, budget 2021 is not the time to be putting on new taxes. I would make one exception to that, which is obviously in relation to taxes on pollution or single-use plastics and things like that. That has to be done soon. There is an issue associated with consumption taxes, which is that they're aggressive. So if there were to be increases on taxes in relation to pollution, carbon and so on, they, in my view, should be offset by increasing social protection rates, or alternatively by reducing other taxes on consumption that are not associated with environmentally damaging activities.
Thanks, Tom. Colette Bennett from Social Justice Ireland, what is your kind of, I suppose, key asks from a social justice perspective in this budget? And I framed it before I asked you all on. I said, you know, what should the budget do that won't actually be done? As in, what do we know are the policies that really should be done? And Trish has mentioned, you know, legislating to end child poverty, increasing, you know, welfare payments. What are the key things you think really should be happening, specific changes that are doable now, but would really make a difference around addressing poverty and inequality?
Well, thanks very much, Rory, and thanks for having me on. Some of the things that both Trisha and Tom have referenced would be our asks as well. So in terms of things like increasing welfare payments, and particularly core welfare payments that weren't touched in the last budget, addressing educational disadvantage, so investing in education, you know, dealing with non-mortgage debt and distressed debt generally, they would be asks that we have anyway. Similarly, around things like reforming the tax reliefs and you know, really taking a good look at the tax expenditures, particularly those in relation to environmentally damaging activities. So, for example, the Central Bank published last year a report that said that there are tax expenditures in the region of about $4 billion a year in that space. So, you know, addressing that, and I don't believe that will be used or that will be properly addressed in this budget, even though it's been an ask of ours. And that frees up then, obviously, income for the Exchequer to make those investments that are desperately needed. So, you know, our key asks would be around things like health. I mean, you cannot have a budget that's not going to have some level of health expenditure, health investment, but whether it'll be the right one is another thing. So I think if we concentrate on, say, acute services, so hospital care, we're missing a huge issue around primary care and community healthcare networks, because that is where we need a significant investment. Sláintecare has been knocking around since 2016. It got cross-party support at the time, and it still hasn't been properly implemented. You know, the $500 million investment per year for 6 years to get the infrastructure up and running just hasn't been made. And that lack of infrastructure at community level is why, or contributes certainly to why, we have the occupancy rates in the acute hospital centres that we do. So at 95%, we've got 20 percentage points higher than the OECD average. And that is now leading to blockages. It's leading to delayed discharges because we don't have sufficient home care. It's also, you know, in terms of where our A&E departments are, we now are in the middle of a pandemic. We're going headfirst into flu season. It's going to have a significant and very fast impact. So we would like to see a major investment package on health. Whether or not that will be made, or whether it will be made in the right spaces, you know, remains to be seen. Obviously, then we want a significant investment in housing, and particularly in social housing. And I know this is an area that you could wax lyrical on, you know, forever, Rory. But, you know, we want to see proper builds and, you know, not necessarily high level, high scale developments, but certainly there's a lot that can be done at a community level, at a kind of a regional level, where you've got high work intensity builds in things like over the shop, in things like, you know, small developments that's creating employment, that's supporting local economies, and is providing accommodation and accommodation across the life cycle. So it's not just, you know, three bed semis. It's, you know, it's accommodation for whatever stage that you need, that you can build community so that you don't have this rural migration, which then leads me on to, nicely done, the regional divide. So that rural urban divide, that's something that needs to be addressed. And again, we've seen it in relation to those who can access services, those who are so far away from services that they may not have them at all. And certainly, you know, big issues around accessing things like college education, accessing things like rural broadband, and just having the ability to work from home for those who are lucky enough to be able to do it.
Great. Thanks, Colette. Michael, what wild and wonderful ideas has SIPTU got for this budget?
Well, first off, about 2 weeks ago, we published a document entitled A Progressive Fiscal Framework to try to address not only the challenges that will arise in trying to repair the damage that's been done by the pandemic, but also to address the challenges of Brexit, climate change, the onset of automation, whereby, you know, hundreds of thousands of jobs could be put at risk due to the what's called the Fourth Industrial Revolution. And another feature which hasn't come on the radar, but which is starting later in this decade, we may be, as the Fiscal Council has advised, entering into a long-term low-growth period because of things like aging society, technological frontiers, and a reduction in investment. So what we need to get from the government is, while they can't do it in one budget, is a clear signal that they will, over the next decade, make the resources available for a sustained and substantial investment program. That is what is needed to confront these, what could be called five challenges ahead of us. And we're looking at things like, well, obviously housing and healthcare, the health sector capacity. We're looking at things like the Green New Deal, telecommunications, public transport, water and waste, a whole range of areas. So that's the first ask. If we want to keep to things which are realistic, which are actually grounded in what the program for government or even ministers have kind of adverted to, the second thing we'd like to see is moves towards greater workplace democracy. Now, we don't expect this government to introduce, a collective bargaining across the board. But they have two opportunities. One is they will be establishing sectoral task forces. These will be task forces that, you know, look at the challenges of sectors as a whole. Department of Enterprise identified 16 sectors, which they gave some analysis to. If there's going to be task forces in those sectors, there must be not only participation by employees through their trade union representatives, there has to be participation by all relevant civil society groups. That's a very small step in terms of workplace democracy. A third thing they could do, and this is, it's actually, it wouldn't be all that much more expensive than what we're doing now, and it would be a game changer. Right now, the government subsidizes early year services to the tune of about 70%. And yet in childcare, we have the highest fees in Europe and some of the lowest paid people in, lowest paid workers in the economy. So what they could do is just step up a little bit more, and they could actually assume the payment of wages to all the employees in the early year sectors. They do this already with early education and primary school, to do that with childcare. Introduce maximum fee thresholds, which they've already referred to in their first five government strategy. And we could then have affordable fees, decent wages and working conditions, and a childcare system that's fit for purpose. And just to say, just to pick up on what Tom says, they could also at least begin to refer to the fact that additional taxation will primarily, not exclusively, but primarily fall on taxation of capital, property, and assets. And already, now when Pascal Donohue was Minister for Finance and the caretaker government, he referred to increasing the inheritance tax. So increasing the inheritance tax and even increasing the top rate of the property tax for households over, houses valued at over €1 million, those would be small steps, but steps in the right direction. So what we want are signals that they're moving to greater democracy, a substantial investment program, greater public services, in particular childcare, and shifting new, getting the new revenue that we will need, not from labor, but from capital, property, and assets.
Thanks, Michael. Tom, I think the government are going to present this as, like, you know, the ultimate, and I think a lot of the narrative will be around, you know, this will be the splurge in government, a government that has never spent as much, they're borrowing, previously unseen amounts, and we're, you know, hitting our deficit, a budget deficit in this situation as well. But how do we measure, will there be a real substantial increase in investment or not? Investment in things that you've mentioned there, like housing, childcare, and not just a kind of a wishy-washy, yes, we're putting this huge amount of money into the economy, which they are, but how can we assess whether that real increase in that long-term investment is taking place or not?
Well, I mean, obviously, on the capital side, we'll just have to see the size of the envelope. What is the final euro amount for 2021, 2022, and so on?
Tom, you can't say stuff like that. We have to see the size of the envelope. People are going to be, what? Do they put the cash in the envelope, is it? Does that mean?
the only way we'll know is by actually digging into the budgetary documentation itself. The speech that the minister makes is usually meaningless. Which re-announces things that have been announced years before, previous plans and so forth. So the only way we'll be able to do that is by digging into the documentation, unfortunately. And we will be able to make that analysis in the hours, days and weeks after the budget. My expectation is that there won't be a major investment stimulus. There may be a reorientation of the existing National Development Plan towards in a slightly more green direction, but I don't believe that the intent of the government is to engage in a major investment stimulus. They've already stated that their intent is actually to kind of tread the needle so that their deficit doesn't get into the outer range of deficits of European countries, because Pascal Donohue doesn't want to be picked off by the markets. So that will be a natural constraint. At the same time, the Department of Finance have released papers showing that they're very, very cautious in terms of letting the deficit get too far away from them. So, the proof will be in the viewing. What is the actual plan that's out there?
Is that the correct approach?
No, my view actually would be that what we need to do is we need to take this as an opportunity to essentially reorient the economy. We have to use this as the initial point in terms of our movement towards a zero carbon future. We need to look at this. We need to look at the opportunity that we have in front of us in terms of virtually zero borrowing costs. So we should borrow tens of billions over the next few years at extremely low interest rates, lock in that debt so it doesn't mature for decades to come, put it away in effectively a wealth fund and use that money to support the investments that we need, both in terms of physical capital, things like infrastructure, but also human capital, so higher level education, retraining, apprenticeships, all of those things that allows us to make a transition to a greener economic model that is also that is inclusive and that is sustainable. That is what we should do. And at the same time, acknowledge that, yes, over the medium to long term, we are going to have to increase the revenue or tax base of the state and identify the ways in which we can do that. And that analysis has been done. Michael has already pointed to capital assets as being one of the two areas where we're low. The other is PRSI, social insurance. So over the medium term, we're going to have to make these adjustments. But for now, we should use 2020 and 2021 to borrow an enormous amount of money, tens of billions, and then use that to make that just transition over the next 5-6 years and indeed beyond.
Tricia, in terms of what you talked about there around addressing child poverty, you know, you mentioned legislating to, you know, end child poverty. What does that mean? What would that mean the government would do? And what do you think, you know, are the three specific things the government should do to try and indicate that it's serious about eradicating child poverty?
I suppose it would firstly would be to set a target. The current target expires at the end of this year, and it's unlikely that they'll meet it. We won't know until next year when the data is released. But I suppose the legislation would just really hold government to account on their commitments to children, because particularly if you're heading into a recession, you know, children and households and families were impacted most negatively by the last recession. So by having it in legislation, making those targets legally binding, putting it at the top of the national agenda, you would hope that it would be used as a tool to hold government account to their commitments in relation to that. But of course, that's not going to be enough. You need investment. And I think firstly, you need income supports, adequate income supports. So investing in things like the qualified child increase, investing in family income supports like the working family payment, supporting low parent families in particular. They're experiencing a lot of challenges at the moment because they're worried about losing their jobs, because maybe they'll have to take time off work if the school closes because there's a local outbreak. There's a lot of concerns there that they'll end up in long-term unemployment, which even a small loss of income can result in a family maybe losing their home and becoming homeless. So really it's about preventative measures there in terms of lone parents. And then, as Michael said, investing in the public provision of childcare is essential if we want to address child poverty. And that needs to be good quality because it needs to work for the children in that it's a good environment to thrive, particularly for children from disadvantaged backgrounds. But it also allows parents to work if that childcare is affordable. And then obviously you also need to have decent wages and living standards for workers as well. And then I think, we've seen over the last number of years, the biggest driver of poverty and financial hardship is housing costs. So unless we address the housing crisis by investing in more social and affordable housing, it'll be very difficult to address child poverty, because housing and poverty are inextricably linked. And we've seen how that's been driving increases in deprivation over the last year, particularly among renters and those in receipt of HAP. So I think in terms of this budget, it's hard to get a sense of what will happen. I think compared to other years, it's just there's so much uncertainty. And there's always this trade-off between investing in building housing, investing in like the public provision of childcare, and keeping things like HAP going, because they do keep people in their home, and that current expenditure versus the capital expenditure. And that's the balance between that is tricky as they're trying to move towards a more progressive and sustainable model of service provision in Ireland. So.
No, that's really, I think, it highlights the kind of the key things that need to be done there to address that. Colette, do you think, like, in terms of Social Justice Ireland analysing the budget, and we heard that Tricia mention earlier that and it's the talk about this well-being measurement, what framework or what way should we measure is this budget actually taking poverty and inequality serious?
Well, I think, this budget, and it is an interesting one, and Tricia pointed it out there as well, that there's a lot of unknowns around what they're going to do. And there's been a lot of kind of smoke and mirrors about it. On the one hand, there were reports about it going to be a well-being budget. Then on the other, there's reports of, having to be careful around the deficit and having to, not wanting to be an outlier in terms of Europe, and particularly with Minister Donoghue's current position at Europe, so there's all of that. And I think if we want to provide a proper well-being budget, then it needs to look at, well, actually, where are we as a society? So, we have been talking about the social contract for a long time now. We produced a document this year on the social contract, and it sets out kind of the five pillars, a framework of what we would like to see in terms of being able to provide the well-being of Irish society. So we look at things like, a vibrant economy. So when we talk about that in this context, we're talking about exactly what Tom is talking about in terms of borrowing at ridiculously low, low, low rates and locking them in, and not being afraid of that borrowing, not thinking of it as, this big massive mortgage that we have to pay off as quickly as possible, but actually as something that is absolutely necessary to run the economy of a country at the moment. So that would be an element of that first pillar. Then we talk about decent services and infrastructure and how, we need to invest in all of that and see it properly as an investment and not just as a current or capital expenditure, that it's actually, if people have decent homes and they have access to decent healthcare and they have, sustainably financed childcare, they can participate meaningfully, whether that's in society, whether that's in communities, whether that's in the labour force. So it is an investment in people as well as in things, as in infrastructure. Then we go on to, you know, a just taxation system. And again, we talked about, you know, the need to properly look at the tax release and the tax expenditure system and to have those properly accounted for and reviewed and have sunset clauses and, you know, make them part of the budgetary process, for example. But also then those things that both Tom and Michael talked about in terms of increasing expenditures into the longer, to medium and longer term. We then look at things like good governance. So having things like social dialogue, having all of the parties around the table to actually, you know, feed into policies, to discuss policies that are going to affect all sectors of society. So having all sectors of society around the table, not just a select few, not just, you know, the political kind of establishment, but also, you know, the community sector, the employers, ICTU, everybody. We need to be, you know, properly making decisions that include those who are going to be impacted by it. And I have the kind of example that I use all the time when I'm talking to kind of community groups around policy, which is you cannot buy a slice of bread or a packet of bread without being impacted by policy, from what's in it to how much it costs to how it's packaged. So, it, you know, there's no one that policy doesn't affect. So everybody should get to have a say in how it's shaped. And then finally, we'd look at sustainability, and that's obviously sustainability in terms of the environment. But, and, you know, a just transition is hugely important. So Tom talked about the regressive nature of, you know, consumer taxes, for example. And we talked last year, there was a huge amount of discussion around the carbon tax. But that obviously then needs to be offset for those who are on low incomes or those low income households in terms of a just transition. So rather than penalizing people because they, you know, their housing heating system is reliant on carbon fuels, that there is some level of, you know, a proportionate response for low income households. But when we talk about sustainability, it's also in relation to the sustainability of all of the other measures. So we talk about work that has to be decent work that is sustainable into the future, that provides at least towards a living wage. And Tricia talked earlier on about the fact that, you know, poverty is very much being driven lately by increases in housing costs. And we know for a fact that the living wage, you know, that's currently set at 1230, the increases in that have been very much driven in the last few years by the increase in housing costs. So, you know, we need to address all of this as a whole, because if you concentrate only on one thing, and you go back to the 2008 response where we concentrated only on getting the deficit reduced or getting the economy back up on its feet, we miss out on all of the other things, and we cannot simply look towards austerity again to make up for the difference. So, you know, that would be the kind of framework that we would be looking at. But in terms of, you know, what do you need in well-being? I think one of the things to come out from the pandemic has been, not that it's been a great leveler, because it certainly hasn't, but it has really shone a light on the areas that, you know, everybody on this podcast has been talking about for so long. So the need to have adequate housing, and that's adequate accommodation for everybody. So whether that's, you know, people in the private rented market, whether that's people in communal establishments and how suitable they are, direct provision, domestic abuse refuges, all of that has a part to play. So we need to look at actually really addressing that, because now we know just how dangerous all of that is. Similar in terms of our healthcare system and the deficiencies in that. And, you know, they have been really brought into relief with the current context. But that's been something that was bound to happen. You know, we haven't had a proper healthcare system in a very long time. Similarly then, in terms of childcare, so the lack of access to childcare meant that a lot of frontline workers had great difficulty in getting to their frontline jobs. So we really need to have more sustainability in all of these areas that have been highlighted by our current context, but actually make them sustainable into the future.
Thanks, Colette. Michael, I suppose, do you think that this budget is going to see a shift, or is it going to continue the fiscal conservative approach that we have seen dominating this country for decades?
I don't think there will be any significant shifts, though there have been indications here and there. I mean, for instance, the very fact that in the program for government, for the first time in a long time, a government has now opened the door to increasing employers' social insurance, which could help pay for a proper universal sick pay plan for all employees, or proper levels of unemployment benefit, or indeed healthcare. So, I mean, there are some indications here and there, but by and large, I think what we'll see is that the government will spend what they need to do for next year. It won't be as much as this year because the deficit will fall, both in, you know, in the actual amount, but in relation to growth, because all things being equal, you know, avoiding a very serious second lockdown, we're likely to see jobs increasing, tax revenue increasing, business activity increasing, and fall in unemployment costs. What I think the key thing to look out for is when they publish their projections out to 2025 or 2026. Now, they say they're not going to do that. They usually do that in the budget. They're not going to do that until early next year. And to be honest, you'd have some sympathy with that. There's no sense in, you know, publishing projections which overnight could change due to events that you have no control over, such as the spread of the virus. But what would be interesting to see in those projections is, are they still locked into the orthodoxy of a balanced budget? If that is what they're moving towards by the middle of this decade, then that will mean enormous amount of resources will be squandered, that you will have not austerity above the radar, but you'll have what's called austerity below the radar. In other words, public services expenditure on public services will rise over the 5 years, but when you factor in inflation and population growth, you actually find that it's staying static, if not even falling. So those are the key things to judge to what extent they are willing to break away from the orthodoxy of a balanced budget and use this time, as Tom says, just to borrow everything you can get your hands on at the cheapest rate possible. I mean, only 2 weeks ago, the government issued a 10-11 year bond, and it was a negative interest rate. The lenders were actually paying us for the privilege of lending us the money. I mean, you could almost make a cottage industry out of it. But that just shows how weird the situation is, but also the opportunities to amass the resources that we need to continually drive economic and social infrastructure, especially in the key areas of education and public services, to drive that over the next decade. But we really probably won't get a sense of that until early next year.
Thanks, Michael. Tricia, do you see the kind of debate? How do you see this debate around this budget been framed? What do you think? Do you think it's going to be the dominance of this idea of, well, we're spending so much and we have to keep the budget, you know, balanced, and that these kind of arguments that we're making and putting forward here will really not get listened to? Or do you think that there is a, you know, the COVID, as Colette talked about, you know, the shift in how people are seeing, you know, our economy, our society as a result of COVID, shining a light on inequality and the lack of investment, that maybe that opens up the possibility that actually, you know, there will be some meaningful debate in the public sphere around, is this actually budget addressing things or not?
I suppose we're optimistic that it will be, just in terms of was a sense, at least at the start of the pandemic, that there's an opportunity to do things differently. But I think then when the programme for government negotiations got underway, it would turn to discussion about reducing the deficit, and a lot of the kind of positive inclinations towards more investment moved away. But I think one example where I can see there could potentially be issues is that, you know, the Minister for Public Expenditure said that if we're to continue or reverse the cuts to the pandemic unemployment payment, that will have to be considered in terms of wider welfare measures. So yeah, it might be a choice between, well, we can keep the PUP payment going, or we can increase core social welfare rates for people who maybe were out of the labour market before the pandemic. So that would kind of ring alarm bells for us, because they really need to do both if we want to prevent a dramatic increase in poverty. Because if, you know, the pandemic on unemployment payment has worked, it has kept households afloat, and if they're in the private rented sector and they're able to access the more flexible version of rent supplement, you know, that's really helped a lot of people who haven't been able to get back to work straight away. So if we're being forced to make those kind of choices, and if that's being put forward as the choice that might have to be made, then I would be concerned about the overall framing of this budget and how it will actually maybe potentially leave the people that SVP are supporting behind.
Yeah, and Tom, coming to a close, do you think that it is possible or economically sound to increase the the pandemic unemployment payment reinstated, plus increase those welfare payments that Tricia has talked about?
I would see it as essential. I mean, look, everything we do is ultimately a choice. We're a very rich country. We can absolutely afford to do that. The deficit is going to be enormous next year, no matter which way you cut it. So the additional costs associated with bringing the pandemic unemployment payment back in the direction it was earlier this year, plus increases in social protection payments, actually won't make a huge difference in the long run. But the problem fundamentally is that our revenue base is too low compared to other Western European countries, and that forces us to cut our cloth across all areas of public spending. So I think we need to be thinking about the budget in terms of not just 2021, but we have to make sure that 2021 is a support budget that protects people and protects jobs as well. But we need to be thinking about the medium term of, okay, well, what's the type of economy and society that we want to have in 2025, 2030 and 2035? And I mean, you're talking about a debt of over 200 billion already. So sums in the tunes of tens and hundreds of millions in the greater scheme of things won't make a difference to the long-term debt interest burden, but it will make a massive difference to those people themselves. So we need to be very, very careful that we don't make short-term mistakes in terms of being parsimonious and cutting corners in particular areas, that there's a lot of damage to people in the short run. We need to be looking at this as a support phase. The government needs to step in. It needs to protect families, households, businesses, employees, and gradually reduce its stimulus as you get into the early 2020s. And at that stage, you start to increase the revenue base of the state in all the ways that Michael identified and collected too, in terms of tax breaks and so forth. So, no, to answer your question, I don't believe it would be a mistake. And I do believe, I'm absolutely convinced that we can certainly afford to do all of those things.
I just make the point, Rory, you know, this is why, you know, it is so important to kind of delve into these numbers and get under the numbers, because what we will see in the budget, you know, is there will be, as Tom said, there'll be rehashing of old programs that were announced. There'll be the odd few goodies. They will try to direct the coverage of the media, of the budget and the consumption of the budget by, you know, the public debate in certain ways. But let's take a look at PUP. And maybe Tricia will have the actual numbers, but I think it's been said that something like 2.1 billion euros have been spent on PUP already. And of course, that big number is supposed to frighten us somehow. Actually, if it wasn't for PUP, we still would have been spending about 1.7, 1.8 billion on just ordinary unemployment payments. Mm-hmm. So PUP has not actually cost, you know, 2 billion euros. It's actually cost just a little bit above what ordinary unemployment payments would have been. So the idea that you can't extend PUP because of its cost is ridiculous. A few hundred million in a budget deficit of what, 20, 25, 30 billion? It's absolute peanuts, but it would be so beneficial and helpful to those households that are benefit. So in this budget debate, not only up to, but afterwards, I think, you know, people, you know, the groups like NERI and Social Justice Ireland and Vincent de Paul and other groups need to really get under the numbers so that people aren't being fooled. It's not about saying, oh, the government is lying to us, but listen, we know how, you know, stats are molded and positions are molded, and what we've got to do is present present the correct picture to people, because only on that basis can you have sustainable policies going forward.
Yeah, that's great, Michael. Listen, thanks everyone for getting involved and really helping, I think, to explain the kind of what policies should be there. And I think it'll be very useful for listeners. Before you go, and while I'm making a plug for patrons to support us, Pascal was on to me and he said he's going to take one idea from each of you to implement in the budget. So if Pascal is listening, what's the one thing you think he should do? And you can have a think of that while I'm pulling the plug in. So listeners, we need you to help us out in our budget with becoming a patron. Sign up to tortoiseshack.ie on Patreon. These podcasts actually cost money to produce. I'm not paid a huge wage out of it. I'm actually paid zero wage. But Tony, it does cost to host all these. So really, we need you to support us. If you like it, there's a lot of work been done. Please help us out. And now, so who wants to go first?
Can I go first?
Because
I'm going to give you no answer to this. essentially, I don't believe that we can pick one, like, you know, do a Sophie's choice on it and pick your favorite child, because there are so many interrelated
child.
No comment. But because all of these things are so interrelated. I mean, we talked about the impact that housing has on the poverty rate and has on the ability to access work and to access education and things. So I think, you know, it shouldn't be viewed as what should be hit as the priority, because really getting society back on track and getting it up and running essentially should be the priority and moves in that direction.
Great. Thanks, Colette, for joining us. Tom?
Yeah, there isn't a single thing. I mean, how do you choose between housing and childcare, for example? You do both. So I guess the one thing that I would do is make a firm commitment to ensure that we're going to increase and expand universal basic services over the course of the 2020s, and to commit to putting the revenue base in place that will allow us to provide those services in a decommodified way. One supposedly out there one that I would push that not that many countries do is, could we think about massively expanding the public transport system and making public transport free?
Yeah, sounds good. Tricia?
Well, I suppose I'd agree there's not one thing you could do, but we would really like to see the government progress to benchmark social welfare rates and the national minimum wage against the cost of a minimum essential standard of living. So everybody in Ireland has an adequate income to live with dignity would be our main ask.
No, that's a really, really good idea. Great stuff. And finally, Michael.
Well, I agree with everyone. There's not one thing. I think if there was one thing, I think Tricia's contribution is really good. But I will take one thing. It's not a priority. It doesn't exclude everything else. But we can actually make the childcare system affordable. We can actually bring people out of poverty wages and poor working conditions. This would be a great benefit for households. It would be a great benefit for the workers, great benefit for the children. It would also contribute to long-term growth because there would be greater participation in the labor market by parents, and most of all, it would give the clearest signal you could give that this government is going to pursue what Tom referred to as universal basic services, that public services are available to those who are in need and not because of the size of their bank account.
Great. Thanks, Michael. So, Pascal, there you have it now. When you're listening, the ideas are there, set out, very clear. Thanks, everyone, for joining us on Reboot Republic.